This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. What would lead someone to write gritty, savage, and cynical tales of crime? James Ellroy says it all began when he was 10 years old and learned that his mother had been brutally murdered. In the more than three decades since her death, the murder remains unsolved. For Ellroy, those 30 years have included a life of petty crime, alcoholism, and homelessness. And in the last 15 years, a successful career as a writer of darkly drawn crime novels. Ellroy has said that he writes about psychologically flawed people with bad character traits, caught up in bad situations during historical times when political correctness didn't exist. His books include The Black Dahlia, White Jazz, L.A. Confidential, and his latest, a collection of short stories called Hollywood Nocturnes. Ellroy has now turned to nonfiction. The current issue of GQ magazine features an article he wrote about his mother's murder. I wanted to know why he's now going back over the details of the case.
A friend of mine, a reporter named Frank Gerardo of the San Gabriel Valley Tribune, was doing a piece on celebrated or semi-celebrated San Gabriel Valley homicides that went unsolved. He became acquainted with two remarkable men, Sergeants Bill Stoner and Sergeant Bill McComas of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department's Unsolved Unit. The mandate of the Unsolved Unit is to periodically review unsolved homicide with an eye towards assessing where the initial investigating officers screwed up. As soon as I had heard that Frank Gerardo heard the file, I realized that I had to see it and write a piece about it. So I went to my good friend and colleague, the editor at GQ, Paul Scanlon, and said, "Paul, let me write this piece. I want to go out. I want to talk to Bill Stoner. And I want to see the pictures of my mother dead, and I want to read all the paperwork that has accrued since 1958.
But why now did you want to involve yourself deeper in the story of her murder?
Basically, right off the bat, for publicity.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Yes. Because I'm a publicity fiend. I am the Dracula. I am the Frankenstein. I'm the Wolfman of publicity. And I realized that it would be a salutary confrontation.
Nothing deeper than that? I mean, I know that certainly the murder of one's parents, especially a young age, has got to be something that stays with someone their whole life. There was nothing deeper than just...
salutary confrontation. That was it. Yeah. I have exploited my mother. I have exploited her murder over the course of many book tours.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted the woman to speak to me more than me speaking once again about her. Now, parenthetically, an earlier book of mine, my novel The Black Dahlia, this is the story of the 1947 murder of a young woman named Elizabeth Short. This is a murder that is as celebrated as my mother's was publicly neglected. When I went touring for that book in 1987, I saw that there was a very simple cause and effect that even the stupidest journalist on earth could glom onto. A young woman is killed in 1947. The killing goes unsolved. The mother of a young man is killed in 1958. The boy is 10. He becomes obsessed with the Black Dahlia murder case as a way of touching the horror of his own mother's death without getting terribly scalded by the flames. I realized that that was a basic truth, and I realized it was one that I could exploit. But, well, you know, exploitation can only go so far, and exploitation exacts a toll. And I think I wanted to confront the toll that it had taken on me when I wrote the piece for GQ.
So you felt like you owed your mother something.
Yes.
Well, take for us, if you can, back to the late 50s and tell us what was known at that time about how your mother was murdered.
My mother, Geneva Hilliker Ellroy, was an alcoholic. She was promiscuous. She was divorced from my father. She worked as a registered nurse at an electronics plant in Santa Monica, California. She up and moved us 6 months prior to her death to a small crumb-bum town called El Monte in the San Gabriel Valley, east of Los Angeles. I spent the weekends with my father. I spent the weeks with my mother. I spent the weekend of June 21st and 22nd with my father in Hollywood. He brought me back on the bus on the afternoon of Sunday the 22nd. When I got to the house where I lived with my mother, cops were all over the place, and they said, "Son, your mother's been killed. Where's your father?" And they rounded him up at the bus depot. He was waiting to go back to Hollywood. Of course, he couldn't have done it. He was with me at the time of my mother's death.
He was a suspect, though?
He was the initial suspect, right. And he was dismissed very rapidly. What happened was this. My mother went out drinking in a bar in El Monte on the evening of Saturday, June 21st, 1958. Man picked her up, strangled her, dumped her body into some bushes adjoining a Royal High School, and the killing was never solved.
Now, when you had a chance to look in her file when you went to Los Angeles, what did you find in there that interested you in particular?
More than anything else, I saw a milieu, and a milieu of loneliness. Middle-aged people going to a bar on a Saturday night, getting bombed, and having or not having backseat or backroom assignations, maybe going into alcoholic blackouts. You know, certainly telling themselves and telling each other, you know, a good many lies. And the pathos of it all, the sadness, was really enough to make you go on in the stomach.
Did you see pictures of her body in her file?
Yes, I did.
What did they look like?
She was strangled, she was clothed, and she was dumped into some bushes, as I said, adjoining the football field at a Royal High School. As I say in the piece in GQ, lividity had thickened her features. She didn't quite look like my mother. I realize that throughout the years, I've idealized my mother's appearance. There were a number of snapshots of her. I have no snapshots of her. I do now, since I've written the GQ piece. I realized that I had idealized her appearance. I had made her look younger and softer and prettier. She was a boozer. She was a smoker. It showed on her face. She was 43 at the time of her death and looked somewhat older than that.
Hmm.
I saw that the toll that the life that she was living exacted on her.
And the effect on you to look at these pictures that, of course, you hadn't seen in more than 30 years.
I hadn't seen the pictures ever.
Ever.
Yeah.
I mean, the effect on you to see your mother's dead body, what was that?
It was saddening. It was somewhat shocking. My reaction to it was delayed. I'm a professional. I was in a room with half a dozen other men at the time I saw the pictures. I certainly wasn't going to break down and do a boo-hoo number.
Mm-hmm.
It had a belated effect on me, and it's had a cumulative effect on me. And as you may have noted at the end of the piece in GQ, I am going to write a book about my mother,
right,
and her homicide. And what I'm going to do is the following. This fall, Bill Stoner and I, Bill Stoner, the head of the L.A. Sheriff's Department's Unsolved Unit, is now retired. He's a very brilliant detective and one of the most amazing people that I've ever met. He's the man that solved the Cotton Club homicide in the late 1980s. He and I are going to reopen the case ourselves and actively investigate it from here till the end of the earth.
Hmm.
And our investigation will be the dramatic basis of my book.
There's a picture of you in the GQ article, and it's a picture, at least as you write, taken by a news photographer shortly after you are told that your mother is dead.
Right.
He apparently posed you in a, I guess, a workshop or a garage nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And there you are, looking out at the camera with a little tool in your hand over a piece of wood. It looks almost like something out of a yearbook from the 1950s. Now, I don't know what a 10-year-old is supposed to look like after they've just heard that their mother is murdered. But I looked at that picture and I couldn't read you. I didn't know what was going on for you.
I comment on that very thing that you have noticed in the course of the GQ piece. My grief was instantaneously compromised. I love my father much more than my mother. He was easier on me. He was much more accessible. He wasn't an alcoholic. He was certainly promiscuous, but he hid his promiscuity from me, unlike my mother. And at the time of my mother's death, I was not loving her too much. And some dim reptile part of my brain seized upon the fact that, wow, now I can go live with my father, which was something I dearly wanted to do.
You talk about reopening this case and taking it as far as it will go. Of course, the idea of trying to find out who murdered your mother. If you were to find that person, have you thought about what effect that might have on you?
If Stoner and I find the man, we will attempt to bring him to justice. This is not as far-fetched a notion as you might think. Stoner has solved a number of these long-dormant homicides. Things like this do happen. The man my mother left the bar with was in his early 40s in 1958. So he's 78, 79, 81, or 2 years old now. He may well be dead. I don't know what the actuarial tables would say about something like that. If he's still alive, we're going to attempt to find him. There may well be people who are around then who had strong suspicions that weren't questioned by the police. There is an established procedure for finding out these things, and nobody knows it better than Bill Stoner.
Do you think your skills as a crime novelist will help you in tracking down or the murder of your mother?
I think I understand the inner logic of homicide investigations. And one of the first things that Stoner and I are going to be doing this fall is examining my mock-up of what I think we should be doing. I'm very curious to run this by him and see how much of this is the established procedure. Because the thing about writing crime fiction is this. As good as it is, as socially potent as it can be, as well as it can illustrate American society, most of it is rebop, shuck, and jive. I tell lies for a living. Stoner unearthed truths for 33 years of his life as a deputy sheriff. I want to hit right on the snout the fiction-fact dichotomy. I want to hit it on the snout with a big nail-studded 2x4. I want to dig as far into myself as I can, as far as I can into Stoner, his life story, my life story, the story of my mother from her birth in Tunnel City, Wisconsin in April of 1915 to her death in El Monte, California in June of 1958.
Well, you seem to imply in the GQ article that if your mother hadn't been murdered, you would not be a writer of crime fiction. Is that
true? The die was cast. I was a big reader already, but as soon as my mother died, my reading focused centered on true life accounts of crime. True life occurrence of psychosexual behavior. I had an inexhaustible and perverse curiosity for anything pertaining to crime. Crime fiction, kids' crime fiction, graduating into adult crime fiction.
Well, I want to talk more, but first we're going to take a very short break. And my guest on Fresh Air is James Elroy. He's a writer of crime fiction. He has a new book out called Hollywood Nocturnes. He also has a piece in the August edition of GQ magazine about his mother's murder, which happened when he was 10 years old. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Elroy. He writes crime detective novels or crime fiction, and his latest book is called Hollywood Nocturnes, and he also has a piece in the August edition of GQ about his mother's murder. I want to just pick up on some of the strands of your life before we get back to the kind of writing you've done and how the pieces of your mother's real-life murder have shown up in some of your novels. But after she died, I know that you went to live with your father, and as you said, this was something that you really wanted to do.
Yes.
What was it like to live with him, and how different was that from living with your mother?
It was very, very different. My mother and my father shared one thing, and that was a love of the flesh. She liked men. He liked women. They did not hide this lust of theirs under a bushel. They were horned out sex fans, you know, from the gate.
And you knew that as a kid?
Oh yeah,
It was obvious.
Yeah, the great story about my father is this, and he was a tremendous, tremendous liar and fabricator, and a you know what artist that we can't say on the air. When I was about 14 years old, he said, you know, Jimmy, I used to go to bed with Rita Hayworth, and I said, Dad, you lie. You lie like a rug. You didn't go to bed with Rita Hayworth. He said, yeah, I did. I had an affair with her in the late 1940s, around the time you were born. So I forgot about it. About 10 years after my father's death, in 1965, I saw a biography of Rita Hayworth in a bookstore window in Los Angeles. And I went in and looked up my father's name in the index. And, oh, yeah, he was her business manager in the late 1940s.
So there was...
It's possibility.
Possibility.
Yeah, and I hope it's true.
Well, his dying words to you, I understand, were, son, try to pick up every waitress who serves you.
Yes.
He wanted you to carry on the family legacy.
The legacy I fulfilled with, you know, mixed results, to say the least.
But you did carry it on.
I tried.
Well, I understand that living with your father, you started shoplifting. Is that right? Or had that started earlier?
I went to live with my father in this pad south of Hollywood, cheap pad. We had a beagle dog who was unhousebroken. The place stunk to high heavens. My father used to hang out in the backyard of our apartment building in his boxer shorts and laugh when nothing was funny and watch the fights on TV and earn just enough money to support the two of us, i.e. three hots and a cot. And I was always sticking my snout in the book. I was walking the dog. I was prowling around with the dog late at night and looking in windows and watching women undress. And as I got older, I started shoplifting. I started swimming trunks, hang ten swimming trunks.
What? That was one of the things you went after?
Yeah, because I sold them to the kids at high school. Yeah, I stole them from Mattson's department store on Hollywood Boulevard in Los Angeles.
How would you do that?
Well, I'd take five or six pairs, you know, into the men's room there, you know, the dressing room, and try them on. And I was a big, rangy, skinny kid, and I'd pull my pants on top of them and put two pairs back on the rack and walk out with several and sell them.
And after that, what other kinds of things would you steal?
I would steal anything that wasn't nailed down. My father would give me $20 to go to the store. I would steal the food that he wanted, if I could, and bring him back change from a tin, things like this.
Did you ever get caught when you were young?
Yeah, many, many times.
And what was the punishment?
Many, many times. Yeah. Well, as I got older, I started doing county jail time for shoplifting, for drunk driving, for burglary. I used to break into houses and sniff women's undergarments.
Really?
Yeah. I was a panty sniffer.
I mean, you went in with that purpose in mind?
Yeah, yeah. I was a little freak, fetishist, misanthropic geek. I mean, I was about 6'3 and 140 pounds, and 50 pounds of it was zits. And I was an acquired taste that nobody ever acquired. I was in love with a girl from my neighborhood. I grew up right on the edge of Hancock Park in Los Angeles, which was quite waspy and wealthy. And I was in love with a girl named Kathy Montgomery. And I used to break into her pad all the time and raid her weed stash and steal things out of the icebox and raid her lingerie drawer.
So were you scared when you did this?
Yeah, but it was a thrill.
But you liked that?
Yeah, yeah, I dug it. And all my books, to one degree or another, feature burglary. And it's a thrill. It's one of the big thrills. I would not rate burglary up there with writing crime fiction, self-publicity, or sex, but it's got to be fourth or fifth.
Yeah. I understand.
And I haven't done it in a number of years, too.
Yeah. Do you miss it?
No. I am the world's squarest, most happily married, devoted husband and dog, you know, on earth. I just did a bunch of crazy stuff while I was a kid.
Right. You still a voyeur, though?
No.
I mean voyeur in the way...
I'm very, very curious
about people
in their lives. Yeah, right. I'm curious, you know, especially about their sexuality. And I put it out there on the page. Mm. I don't have to look in windows.
You started drinking around 1964.
Right.
So you were about 15 years old?
I was 16 in 64.
Yeah. I mean, was this just drinking with the guys kind of thing, or...?
I didn't have any friends back then. I was bopping down the street one day in the summer of 1963, and I was 15. And my options were go to a movie, go to the library, get a book, buy a book, steal a book, ride around on my bicycle, ride out to the beach, go to Pacific Ocean Park or something. And a little voice said, get drunk. So I hot-footed it down to this place called Liquor and Food Mart at the corner of Beverly and St. Andrews in Los Angeles, near where I lived. And I boosted a bottle of Taylor New York State Champagne. And I took it back up to Robert Burns Park on the corner of Beverly and Van Ness. And I popped a cork and hit myself right in the eye, and it hurt. And I guzzled the bottle. And I exposed myself to a girl named Michelle, who I'd been in love with for many years.
After you drank?
Yeah. And chased her around the park in that condition. And the next thing I knew, I woke up, and I was at home on my bed, and my father was looking down at me, and he was saying, you're going to be a bleep, bleep, drunk, just like your mother. And he was right.
Wow.
So I went into a big blackout the first time I got drunk.
So, and as I understand, having read a little bit about your life, I mean, you really went down that road.
Yeah, I got kicked out of high school in 65. I enlisted in the Army. I faked a nervous breakdown. I got kicked out of the Army. I came back to L.A. I went crazy until I got sober in 1977. I did county jail time. Not the big house. And I mean, only for 10 and 15 and 20 and 45 days at a pop. And I got sober when I was 29 and started writing books.
What do you remember from that time at all? Much of anything?
I'll tell you. It was awful. I was always terrified. I was always in some sort of depressed or hopped up state. I was ravaged by guilt and doubt and terrible emotions. Looking back on it now, it almost seems picaresque to me. I can regale my wife for hours at a time of my preposterous, moronic misadventures between the years of 1964 and 1977. I mean, Helen will just howl. She howls like a hyena when I tell her some of the stupid things that I did.
But as
it's
you,
stupid and pathetic.
Yeah. So you got sober in 77. How did you do that?
I got sober.
I mean, you just decided the hell with this?
Yeah. Yeah.
And was that hard?
Yeah. But I wanted it. I wanted to have a life. I wanted to be with women. I wanted to write books.
What, though, had changed to get you to that point that you
won? It was over. I knew it. I knew it. I couldn't run from myself any longer.
So, did you go to group meetings?
I went to AA. If I were still going to AA, see, mm-hmm. I would not violate my anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films, which is one of the key traditions of Alcoholics
right.
Anonymous.
Right.
But I went to AA for about 5 years.
And you found it helpful?
Yeah. Yeah, it saved my life.
So do you miss drinking at all?
No. No. I don't miss drinking. I don't miss, using drugs. I don't miss being broke. I don't miss, going to jail. I don't miss sleeping in parks. Mm-hmm. I don't miss being sick all the time. I have a great life. Yeah. The piece in GQ, you may think that it's dark. You may even think that it's morose. But I am probably the most transcendently happy and fulfilled human being that I know.
James Ellroy writes crime novels. His latest is a collection of short stories called Hollywood Nocturnes. His article about his mother's murder is in this month's GQ. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.